What's up, guys? Doug Polk here, and welcome back to the Doug Polk Podcast. Today, we have a legend of the online poker streets turned into an e-commerce wizard slash DeFi expert. Cole South is going to be joining us. Maybe I shouldn't say expert. I don't know how you feel about that. We're going to hear from him in a second. But before we do, I want to let you guys know that today's podcast is brought to you by CoinFlex. CoinFlex is a cryptocurrency derivatives exchange and is the home of crypto yield for people to both trade and earn crypto. The CoinFlex platform provides an array of products that serve investors and traders of all skill levels, from passive beginners to active experts. What I'm most excited about with our new partnership with CoinFlex is exploring the many opportunities that people can use to make money today. Whether it's trading, automated market making, or simply holding Flex USD, there are so many ways to explore earning money now. CoinFlex can help you make the most from crypto, allowing you an opportunity to take charge and chart your own course to your financial destiny. So what are you waiting for? Head on over and check out CoinFlex at www.coinflex.com. Legal disclaimer, none of the information contained here constitutes an offer to buy or sell any currency, product, or financial instrument, to make any investment, or to participate in any particular trading strategy. We now add in today's guest, Cole. Thank you for joining us today.
Hey, Doug. Thanks for having me.
No problem. I realized when I said DeFi expert, that might be a little too strong. You always want to be careful with calling anyone a DeFi expert. But I've wanted to have you on this podcast for a long time. I just want to kick it off by saying thank you for coming on.
Yeah, my pleasure, man. Your thumbnail and title team is on point. They're cracking me up with the preview there.
Yeah, we have a lot of creativity in the try and drop people in streets. It's funny because on the audio platforms, we have the more appropriate title. It'll say, Cole South, our guest, and we'll talk about... But on YouTube, you kind of have to play the clickbait game, which is just a truth of life. So,
for sure.
A lot of different stuff I want to talk about today, but I want to kick it off with a story for the listeners of the podcast. I don't remember which World Series of Poker it was. I'm going to say it was 2007 or 8, maybe 8. And I remember going to the Rio and someone said, Cole South is here. And I remember thinking, wow, Cole South. And then I met you in like one of the Rio hallways. And I was like, this guy's a complete boss. I remember being so, I was so impressed. I was like, this is the coolest thing ever, meeting Cole South. So I just want to kick it off by saying I was a Cole South fan for many years coming up in online poker. I think kind of my generation looked up to, you know, you, Taylor Cabey, kind of Krantz, that sort of generation of the online poker legends. And it's kind of surreal now to actually have you on the podcast.
Well, thanks, man. I appreciate that. Always looked up to your poker career as well. And I'm sure in that real hallway, I probably was super awkward in coming back to you. My wife loves to tell the story of how this online player was at Bellagio once when I was playing. And his girlfriend brought him over to me and was like, oh, this guy like loves to watch your card earners videos, to watch your play. Can you make an autograph or sign an autograph for him? I'm like, autograph? I don't even know what. So she hands me like a piece of paper and a pen. And like, I literally print my name. Like, I didn't even sign it. Just like, oh, this is so foreign to me. The kind of fame side of poker for sure.
I have the opposite problem. When people ask me to sign my name, my signature is terrible. It just looks like squigglies. So I say, this is how I sign my name. And they go, it's cool. But I look at it and I'm like, I don't know if this is cool. So today I wanted to start off with going into a little bit of your backstory in poker. I think that people that are maybe a little older in their 30s, late 20s even, will of course know who you are. But I think some of the newer generation of poker are probably not going to be as familiar with your story. And I want to kick this off with a tantalizing question for you. You don't have to disclose this, of course. But what did you start with in poker? And by the time you had moved on from poker being your main career, how much money had you made playing poker?
Well, at least answer the first part of the question. So this probably started with a combined $300 split over a few small deposits. I started playing poker in 2004, 2005. It's kind of like right when Moneymaker was at the final table World Series of Poker. Poker was really heating up just as far as like an overall trend in the US in particular. And when I was in college, this was sophomore year of college, party poker ads were on TV everywhere. So I deposited some money on party poker, probably 50 or 100 bucks at the time, like as a college student, decent chunk of money to where it was painful to lose the first couple deposits. But I could tell that, like, you know, I wasn't all that good at this, but the games were super soft at that point. I was playing mostly full ring limit hold'em. I'd gone to the library and got Phil Hellmuth's book. So I knew, you know, pocket sevens are better. His only hands on plan from any position. Don't worry about position too much. And then see all showdowns. And that was a winning strategy at the time. And yeah, so I'd start off at like, you know, 10 cent a quarter or something like that, work it up. And then eventually, you know, get the degen streak, buy into, you know, a 10, 20 limit holding table with my entire roll and bust it. So that a couple times after working, you know, 50 or 100 bucks up to maybe 1,000. And then over Christmas break, sophomore year, I was like, all right, I'm going to make one last deposit of 100 bucks. I'm like, actually going to take this bankroll management thing seriously. Start with, I want to say 300 big bets or whatever before moving up to the next level. And that time it finally stuck. I think bankroll management was kind of the missing key to that. And then like any good poker story, I had an MTT bank in there. I played like some random $20 party poker tournament without knowing anything, because at the time I was only playing limit hold'em, and got like third in it for maybe $6,000 or $7,000, which quickly, you know, jumped me up from say 50 cent a dollar to 5-10 limit hold'em or whatever.
The MTT bank is a pretty clutch way to go. I actually, in my career, I never really had that until I was sort of done playing cash. I didn't actually get the random boost, but a lot of my friends did, and I was always real salty about it.
It helps.
God damn, why can't this happen to me? I have to grind out all these buy-ins, fees is binking LAPT tournaments and just making it rain down in Costa Rica or wherever he was. So anyway, going back to those days, talking about limit hold'em, I think the limit hold'em wave had more or less died out, even kind of by the time I got involved in 2007, 2008. I'm sure there were still some people playing. There was a little bit of a high stakes scene, but overall, the limit hold'em games were more or less replaced by the no limit games in a fairly short order. Did you struggle at all with that transition, or was it a very natural fit for you to move from limit hold'em over to no limit?
No, I struggled a lot. I remember the first day I played no limit hold'em, I sat down at 2-4 no limit on Party Poker. And I don't know, 2-4 limit is a really small game, but 2-4 no limit, I can't remember at the time if it might have been a 50 big blind cap where you could only buy in for 200 bucks. But still, I immediately just smoked off 10 buy-ins, which was like way more than I was planning on sitting down on the table. And I could quickly tell that, hey, this game is significantly more complex than limit hold'em. Really interesting, even though I got crushed. I could tell it was something that I wanted to shift my focuses there. And I could kind of see what you're saying too, that limit hold'em was dying in popularity. And when you would just look at the lobby, all the actions, all the big pots were no limit games. So at that point, I really shifted my focus and was strictly playing no limit.
It's kind of interesting how that's evolved today, where there still is a fairly wide number, a fairly large number of people that like playing limit games, but they've kind of moved over from playing in a lot of the no limit, or sorry, the Texas Hold'em limit games, and they're playing in a lot of mixed games. That team tends to be the ones that people want to play. Like if you look at Bobby's room, a lot of the time it's going to be limit games running, but it's not going to be limit hold'em. Maybe once in a while as part of a mix that it is, but it's primarily going to be a lot of the eight games, triple draw, the stud variants. All that kind of stuff, but Doogie, Badesi. You ever dabbled in any of those limit formats?
Yeah, I used to play a bunch of limit or mixed games, both online as well as in Vegas. I think limit poker is really good for a live setting. It allows like a little bit like of a splashier, slower bleed if you're a recreational player, as opposed to these like big confrontational pots where you're being put all in for like effectively this is going to decide your winning session for the day or not. As opposed to a bunch of small pots, I feel like limit poker is a little bit more friendly in a live setting. And I think that's one big reason why mixed games are so popular.
It's also a bit more face up in some of these spots where, like, let's say that you're in a stud pot and or you're in a raz pot, and then you catch a high card on fifth and your opponent catches a low card. You don't really have to fake tank, pretend that you're serious. Everyone knows that sucked for you. Everyone knows it was good for him. So there's a casualness to it that I actually do think is a lot of fun and a bit different. I think that the draw for no limit is you look at when you're coming up in poker, at least it was like this for me. I looked at the high stakes poker cash games, I looked at the World Series Poker Main Event. I look at all of these types of, you know, the most well-known poker formats, and they're all no limit. And then there's also a simplicity. You get two cards, you can bet whatever you want. That I think is really why No Limit Hold'em is still the most popular game today. All right, so you had this bink, started getting into No Limit Streets. Where did your career go from there?
So I probably started playing strictly No Limit at the start of that spring semester, maybe February or so. And by the end of the semester, I realized that, hey, this is going to be a big opportunity. I'd done really well, won quite a bit of money for coming in as a college student that just didn't, you know, have much money to start with. And I knew that I wanted to take this seriously and take some time off of school. So I was at William & Mary, small public school in Virginia, and left to move out to LA with some other poker guys that summer. And we had one of the kind of first poker houses in Hermosa Beach. It was six or seven of us. And it was super fun. Everybody was kind of working on the game together.
Any other recognizable guys in that crew?
It was all really old school names, like Dan Bright, Billy Jax, Slider. If you were back on 2+2 in the 2005 era, you'd recognize him, but probably not these days.
Not to be a huge downer, but you know what happened to Slider, right?
Yeah, very sad.
Okay.
Actually passed away a couple years ago.
Yeah. We're talking about a friend of mine, Max Bloom. He moved to Vegas. We hung out a bunch. He actually used my home as an address for years. I don't know if I should be saying that on a public podcast, but I got his mail for many, many, many years. And then, he just, I hate saying really horrible stuff on the podcast, but he's a legend of 2+2, a poker player, but he was just found outside of his apartment building. He had jumped or something from one of the high floors, and that was it. That was the only information that was talked about in the subject. Really, really sad story. I was shocked because he's just such an upbeat, happy, nice guy. I don't know if maybe he had problems that we didn't know about, or it was in another country. So I don't know if there was foul play or something. The police didn't really investigate that hard. Terrible.
Yeah, the details were kind of sketchy. And my experience living with Max was very similar to what you said. He was like just one of the most upbeat, positive, outgoing guys. Really, really sad story.
Yeah. Definitely a little suspicious about what happened with that, but it's a sad thing about life. Sometimes stuff like that happens and really you just have to move on, but great guy, definitely a legend. He started a finger spinner company. I still have a little finger spinner.
Oh, yeah.
Remember when those were big for like 1 year? Yeah. Fidget spinner, not finger spinner, fidget. Yeah. Anyway, so poker house, that was pretty standard. I think most people, when they're coming up in the game, late teenage years, early 20s, you just roll up with a bunch of your bros, you rent out a house, and then you're all part of a crew. And I felt like poker had real different, like local crews. That still exists to some extent, but I feel like now it's a little more nationally. Like there are the Germans in tournaments, at least there has been for some number of years, and there's maybe a couple of different American cliques, but there were so many small little pockets of different households of poker players because there was just so much poker happening both online and live that it was funny seeing who was in what group, and you kind of knew those were good times. I enjoyed those days.
I feel like a big difference back then too is strategy was so disparate. People were playing wildly different strategies from click to click. And a lot of them having a lot of success despite playing poker very differently and clearly thinking about it very differently. Whereas now I feel like strategies evolved so much that at the very least people are trying to emulate a similar kind of solver based style that is not exploitative and playing completely differently than say the other nationalist group they're playing against.
Definitely. On that note, you have been one of the pioneers of no limit hold'em strategy, of course, with the variety of training perks that you were either an owner of or part of, such as Card Runners. I had another question on here. Someone asked me, what the hell was Ivy Poker? Maybe we can get to that later too. But you've always been one of the pioneers of poker strategy. I think about Let There Be Range, this book that you sold, this ebook that you sold a good number of years ago now. I forgot what year that was released. What was the process of thinking about strategy like for you back then? How did you study? How did you come to these conclusions? Because nowadays, people kind of take it for granted. Oh, we just know the things that are good. Well, we didn't always know those things. We actually had to think about stuff and try and figure it out. What was your process like to try and improve at poker?
For sure. So I'd say when I started out, I was focusing more on the big pots. Like, hey, every session, I want to review every time I got stacked and make sure I'm not making any massive errors in these big pots. And that was super helpful. I could both evaluate my play as well as like try to get in the heads of the other regs I was playing and reverse engineer unique things they were doing that weren't parts of my game. I say like as my poker career evolved, I was focusing less on the big pots and more on the more frequent situations. Like something like big blind defense. If you're playing heads up no limit and you're defending 30% of your big blinds, it doesn't really matter how good you're doing in the big pots when you're folding 70% of the hands. So I think that's kind of like how the way I thought about poker shifted throughout my career.
That's a pretty normal progression for most good no limit players. You reach this point where you're just thinking about big blind defense in kind of whatever game, and you realize, oh, I need to make sure I'm defending enough or my opponent can just raise really wide against me. Okay, well, how much should I defend? Should I tailor it more based on what they're opening? Should I tailor it more based on what, you know, the direct odds here are? What do I think my equity realization is going to be here out of position? Because now it's going to be much worse than it would have been back in the day where people would play quite weak post-flop. So these were all sort of things that you definitely had to think about. But were there any tools that were available to you? You just look at, just pull up your hold'em manager and just look at hands, or was that basically it?
Yeah, hold'em manager, looking at hands was the main thing. I remember like at a super old school like poker calculator, 2dimes.net. I don't know if you ever used that one, and like Poker Stove a little bit, where you could make ranges and have like ranges compete against each other. But I mean, compared to the stuff that people are using today, just night and day. And I feel like hand review was kind of the most important part for me, because the actual math behind it is relatively basic, you know?
Yeah. So when you started to play higher stakes, did you play more ring or did you play heads up? My understanding is you kind of played a little bit of everything, right?
Yep. I definitely, like towards the end of my career when I was playing only PLO, I preferred to play heads up, but you can only get so much action, you know, waiting heads up across a bunch of different sites, that I ended up playing probably half my volume at ring and half heads up.
So around the Isildur run up times, the Isildur run up days, did you play against him? I think you did, right? You played it. So some of the 500K PLO battles, he was playing you, he was playing Hastings, he was playing
Antonius, Tom Dwan, Phil Ivey. Yep.
How did you do in those games?
Well, I can't exactly remember like what my net results came out to be. But as was famously reported at the time, like with those poker clicks, me and Brian Townsend and Brian Hastings were three of the players that were playing Isildur and his click a bunch. And the three of us, talk strategy a bunch, were influential on each other's poker games, and then would share action in heads up games against Isildur. So I know as a group, the three of us came out way ahead against him, but individually, I'm not sure how I ended up doing.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that were unhappy about that. I think a big part of that is Isildur has a pretty large fan base, and poker is kind of interesting, where when people have their hero, no matter what, it's the other guy's fault. I'm not saying that sharing hand histories and all that kind of stuff is something that is a cool thing to do against high stakes opponents, but most high stakes players that are in different crews of people will talk hands, will show hand histories, will talk about spots. And the reality is, let's say that someone's going to play 500 to 1K and you're taking a big piece of them and they say, well, how does this guy play? I don't think you're breaking terms of service by saying, okay, well, in this spot, he tends to be like this, and this spot tends to be like that. These are just things that you're allowed to say, right? So obviously you get a little bit of a gray area with what happened there. I know there's been different.
Let's go into what happened there first off.
Well, okay, let's do it. Go for it. Okay.
So basically at the time, Brian Hastings had a huge session against Isildur where he busted his full tilt account for $4 or $5 million in the course of an hour and a half session or something. And then Brian,
by the way, insane.
Yeah.
Insane.
I mean, especially, at that time where like the 10-20 game on Party Poker was like the biggest game around, not that far before, just a few years before. So they'd be having a $4 million session, just ridiculous swings. But then Brian gave a interview to an ESPN reporter. This ESPN reporter was not a high stakes poker player and doesn't know a lot about like the mechanics of poker. And I don't know what was said in the interview, but the article came out saying something like, we conglomerated our hand histories, I think was the word he said, to come up with a strategy to defeat Isildur. Now, Brian Hastings said this interview was taped, and he's asked for the tapes a bunch of times to say, hey, look, that's not what I said. We want to set the record straight on this. And the ESPN reporter would not give him the tapes, wouldn't release them, wouldn't talk to him at all, just, you know, said buzz off. There was absolutely no conglomeration of hand histories. I know this because I have my hand histories. I never received theirs. I never sent them mine. The strategy we talked about was like all pretty tame stuff, you know, over email or, you know, in a group chat or something, just talking about specific hands and what we would do here and talking about, you know, what areas of his game we thought that he was weak in. But it absolutely was not anything like we compiled all our hand histories in one database, like this article made it seem, and then used, you know, everybody's individual showdown data to figure out what he was doing. That 100% did not happen.
I'm glad
you learned, because like with the ESPN reporter, you know, particularly this is important, like in nowadays, days and age, but like the media has incentives, and the incentives are not necessarily to go back and correct the truth and set, you know, the what actually happened in this match up. It's to create a bunch of drama and create the story that, you know, then pits two sides against each other and makes this massive scene, which totally happened. I think another good like lesson learned at the time was Full Tilt was doing their own internal investigation, and they told all of us that, hey, you guys can't comment on this until the investigation's over. And at the time, we listened to them. Going back, if something like this happened where I felt like I was being totally portrayed incorrectly, I would have immediately just spoken up and say, hey, look, this is what happened. We absolutely did not conglomerate our hand history or something. Because I feel like that, you know, something that, like even you're talking about now that like is kind of etched in the public record, which it just did not happen.
Well, that's fucked up, first off, because I just assumed that it did because none of you guys came forward and really said anything. And so it was just, hey, here's this source that's saying you did. Here's the public's reaction to it. What? And then none of you guys said anything. I didn't know behind the scenes you were told not to say anything. So, I mean, typically speaking, when some fact comes out about someone and they don't refute it, I'm not saying it's 100% guilty, but it's usually pretty likely, and it had just gone on for so many years, I didn't realize that it wasn't true. So that's,
well,
that's
the thing is, like, we eventually did. Like, eventually I hopped on 2+2 because I was just sick of being kind of raked over the coals for this thing that, like, we did not do, and started answering questions. But by then, the narrative had just gone so far off the rails that there was no, you know, correcting everybody's public opinion on it. And I did an interview with Joe Ingram. I talked about this as well. But at that point, it was, you know, too far derailed. And I mean, I was, you know, in my early 20s at the time. I didn't handle it great. And again, like Full Tilt was great to me, but I didn't really have any, you know, particular value to them outside of being one of their roster of pros. So like the important thing for them was to make it look like they were taking this seriously, not to put me, you know, out in a.
Was there another element to this where, at the time, Full Tilt and Card Runners had a business partnership, and I think this is one of the big catalysts for why Card Runners was so successful, was that this partnership with Full Tilt displayed it prominently within their platform and store, and that was a big onboarding ramp for people on to Card Runners. So did that maybe play a role as well, that you kind of have a business tie in here as well?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it made me want to listen to Full Tilt and respect, you know, their request for us to not talk about it during the investigation. I think one of the other, like, you know, kind of tilting double standards at the time was that, you know, everybody loved watching this Isildur account, which was Victor Blom, right? Victor Blom was playing live tournaments sometimes when this account was playing high stakes poker. So like the double standard here of like getting mad about this, where like this account is clearly being multi-accounted on. And then he gave an interview after the fact, just kind of saying he was pissed at what had happened. I don't know. I was pretty fed up with it by the end.
There's always been some suspect Isildur stuff, yeah, and stories. Not that this is confirmed Isildur, but I was playing Luke Schwartz once. I used to play some heads up 8-game and full flush on stars. And this one day he was not playing like himself at all. He was making instant decisions. And one of the I've played a lot versus Isildur, only No Limit. But one of the hallmarks of Isildur playing versus Isildur is the guy is insanely fast. It's just instant. It's just what do you feel is right in every moment. And so Luke Schwartz does not play like that. And then someone messaged me, hey, Isildur is in London right now, and Luke is too. And then I'm in the chat, and I say, hey, who's on this account? Like, what's going on here? And then he messaged me, and he goes, you know what? You're multi-accounting. Someone's on your account. And to this day, he still has this thing where he took that and turned it into you were multi-accounting. Doug was multi. It was Jay Llama on the account. To this day, if you ask him, oh, Doug was He was multi account. It was just, you know what it reminds me of? It's like when people cheat on their significant other, and then you blame them for things because you're suspicious of them. It kind of reminds me of that. It has that same sort of flavor to it. Obviously not confirmed, but just kind of sort of a small example of what could have been an Isildur related activity.
Yeah, he trumped you pretty good there, because all I remember about this story was you being accused of multi accounting with Jay Llama. So I don't even remember the other side.
It was too funny, though. By the way, that session, so we both played on webcam originally because I was worried about him, but him because he was worried about me, too. Mm-hmm. So now me and Luke Schwartz are playing, I think, 200, 408 game or whatever it is, and we're on webcam, and he's just tilting his face off while we're chatting. It was honestly kind of amazing. We would play a hand. You're so fucking punch the wall. It was great. It was just some great online poker stuff. You just never really see that in the online poker streets. But going back to that, and obviously with the media, we don't want to get too derailed. I want to talk about some more poker stuff. But with the way that the media has sort of changed today or over the last 5-10 years, and maybe this is sort of a precursor to it, it really does become about how can I tell the story that is the most salacious I possibly can to make this big, rather than trying to protect the people that are within the story to some extent. But then I see this too with when I'm trying to cover content. Sometimes it's very difficult to know, well, what should you say and how should you present it? And if everyone else is presenting something, then what do I say? So like, for example, going back to your story, if someone had asked me that before, I would have said, well, I think that they did it because that was my understanding of what was promoted. And it's not like I'm anti-Cole South or something. Obviously, I like all three of you guys. I've never really talked to Townsend, but I mean, I've played with Hastings a bunch. He, even though he's had his moments where maybe he was on multi-accounting or whatever people were accusing him of back in the day, but good dude overall. I like Hastings. So I like all you guys, but I just assumed that was true. And so then you become sort of part of the narrative because you don't even realize that you're becoming part of it, and it snowballs.
Yeah, it's hard to unwind that once kind of snowball gets rolling.
All right, so those matches were pretty crazy point in online poker history. Were there any other battles that stood out to you as particularly interesting times in online poker through your career?
Oh man, Zygmunt was one that was always entertaining. He's just such a character, and he and I certainly battle a ton of heads up PLO over the years. Talked a lot of trash, a lot of big pots, but overall, I mean, I really liked playing against him. He was good competitor and always fun to banter with.
As a no limit player, I saw Zygmunt have some years, I'm gonna say 2015, 2016, where he ran up some pretty big numbers online, and it seemed like, and this is my untrained eye, so correct me if I'm wrong, it seemed like he wasn't quite as fundamentally technically sound as a lot of the other high stakes PLO players, yet he just seemed to clobber people in a lot of these games. And it was kind of fun to rail some of those games because you would see him doing sort of unorthodox things in a lot of spots, but then having it work out. Is that true? And do you think that was just more of a function of he was running hot, or was there some kind of mystique to Zygmunt that gave him little edges in some spots that maybe people weren't prepared for?
No, totally. I mean, he was fearless, had great instincts, kind of similar to Isildur in that respect. And I think he did a really good job kind of playing up his image and then typically having the goods more than you think. Based off of like showing a few huge bluffs or getting stacked and caught bluffing. But I think he was really aware of his image and used that to his advantage.
That's a big part of playing heads up as well, is understanding the way that you're viewed. I think generally speaking, people viewed me as more loose and aggressive kind of player. And I, of course, was aware of that. And so in a lot of spots, I would go for much thinner value than I think other players would be able to, because when you have an image sort of in that, sort of like that, you can really value hammer people, and then people get a little bit more afraid of you. And when that happens, a lot of good things happen. Their range get too weak in some spots. They're afraid to raise you in situations they should certainly have raising ranges. All kinds of stuff that can happen that's positive for you. Talking about your PLO transition, then I think that's obviously a much bigger transition to go from no limit to PLO than it is to go from limit hold'em to no limit, right? Because it's obviously the same game. The only thing that's changed is the betting structure. Obviously, that changes it pretty tremendously. But again, same game, 2 cards, 5 come out. What was it like going from no limit to PLO? Did you start at higher stakes? Did you work your way up with it? What was that process like transitioning?
Yeah, first off, I'd actually disagree with you there. I think transitioning from no limit to PLO was a bit more natural. I think getting your head around the aspect of fixed betting structure to, you know, no limit or pot limit betting structure, that, at least for me, was more of a gap than going from 2 cards to 4. So, yeah, I think the transition from no limit to PLO was not that it wasn't difficult, but it wasn't as much of a mindset shift from going from limit hold'em to no limit. I definitely did start out, you know, still playing 10, 20 PLO or something to pick it up. I didn't drop way down in stakes or anything, which, you know, has pros and cons. I'm sure I got smoked the first month or two, but then you also learn playing against good competition where the habits you pick up against those players are habits that are going to be assets for you going forward. Whereas if you stop everything, move down from 50, 100, no limit to 50 cent a dollar PLO, and you sort of emulate your PLO game after the 50 cent dollar players you're playing against, that's more of a liability than as you move up in stakes.
Right. So basically trial by fire. If you go in there, you play the good players, you're going to get some lessons right out of the gate. You're going to see what good players are doing against you. And maybe you give up some EV out of the gate, but longer run, you now improve your strategy enough to where you make up for that difference in value you lose at first.
Totally. That was my approach. Yeah.
I think that's a good approach, but I think that nowadays people do that a lot less. People would rather spend the time sort of in the lab studying solvers, and you can just watch these people play and see what they do and try and emulate it that way. I do miss the days when people would learn by just getting in there, firing up a few tables and just duking it out. And if you got crushed, it was okay because there was some guy you could probably beat the next day. You weren't sweating, is there going to be action later? You lost, you know, you took your lumps, you moved down for a little bit, you found some good spots, you worked your way back up. I do miss those days with online poker where people could duke it out like that and not be afraid to have to drop down.
Yeah, it was really different that back then because there were good games at every level. So if you got knocked back down, you could climb back up. Whereas if you like towards the end of my poker career, as games, you know, dried up at a particular level, let's say in particular from 5-10, the jump there to 25-50. That's like such a massive jump if there's not much in 10-20 games. So if you get knocked out of the 25-50 games on a bad run and you're back down playing 3-6 and 5-10, you're almost kind of stuck there and trapped. And so you really grind a lot to, you know, build that 25-50 roll back up.
What was your life through your poker career? What was your life outside of poker like? Were you all in on playing poker? Did you have a normal life on the side? I've seen people that can be more normal and function with poker. I've seen people that once they get in, they're just playing all night every day. What was your life like outside of poker?
I'd say somewhat in between. I definitely played like a ton of hours and was pretty obsessive about it. I think pretty much anyone that succeeded at the high stakes kind of had to do that. But I also traveled a lot. I moved back to my college town and lived with some college buddies. It's kind of like a normal college life, even though I wasn't going to class for the last couple of years of that. And then ended up moving to Washington, D.C. with a bunch of friends from college. So kind of had like a natural social scene, but certainly was then, you know, playing all-nighters, playing online poker as well.
It's kind of tough to balance that with regular human beings, I found. I ended up having lots of degen friends, whether they were poker players or just degens, which wasn't exactly ideal. I at one point, I realized in my mid-20s, I kind of need to lose a few of these people. And some of it just happened kind of naturally, or good people, we just kind of went our own ways. But it is difficult when you have a job that, especially high-stakes poker, this is something that I think people don't realize when you play lower mid-stakes. You might think, oh, well, when I want to play, I'll play a game. Well, when you play high stakes, it doesn't work like that. You have to figure out what's running, who is the catalyst for these games, what's making them run, what platform is it on, what time period are those running, and then you have to be available. And a lot of times, there would be games in the middle of the night. I remember when I was playing at a bunch of the Malaysia 400, 800 games in Full Tilt, those would run in the middle of the night. So if I wanted to play, I had to be ready at 2 a.m. to play for a lot of money. And so my sleep schedule during those days was like, I'd sleep from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. and then I'd work the night shift. But you end up having to do that quite a lot when you play high stakes poker. And I think it's very difficult to balance those two things.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I still occasionally get woken up by the Full Tilt post blind ding, you know, that you're waiting for. And I know, at least like in the games I was playing, it was typically really streaky. Like three bad players would want to play a bunch 1 month and it would just be like cramming in the hours that month and the games were really good. And then maybe the next 2 months, it'd be kind of dead. So you'd be waiting around a bunch, but there wouldn't be much action. So during that, like the time when the games are good, I certainly tried to put in a ton of hours to make the most of it.
Which absolutely makes sense. A good number of years after I thought you were completely done with online poker, you posted a graph. I don't remember where it was, 2+2 maybe. I forget what platform it was on, where you had said something like, I've been playing a lot of heads up PLO for the last year or two or three or whatever it was. And you had won some ungodly number of buy-ins playing heads up PLO. I kind of feel like you flew under the radar for that. Maybe I just wasn't looking. I don't know. But I actually did play a chunk of heads up PLO. I don't know if we ever battled any sites or anything, but
we did. I remember one hand.
Oh, we did.
Yeah. On PokerStars. Yeah. Yeah. I was on a ski trip to Antarctica. And on the way back, I was in the southern tip of Argentina at like a little cafe, sitting at 25-50 PLO, heads up. And Doug Polk comes and sits me. And I was like, oh, shit, I've been, you know, sweating the high stakes thread. I know Doug's been in the streets of PLO, like clearly a very smart guy, but like I've never given him any action. He just sat. I got to sit against him. Like, he's definitely going to think that, like, I'm going to be trying to bluff him the very first hand. I remember flopping top set on 10-9-5. Turn was a nine, and you had like queen jack nine and got stacked.
Oh no. Yeah, I believe I got stacked. That sounds like my experience playing PLO.
Yeah, it's like 30 hands, one buy-in. I'm like, all right, that's my career against Doug.
Nice.
Pulled that over him 10 years later in an interview.
Great. Perfect. Well, here you go. I hope the payoff. Well, you got paid off twice, actually, it looks like. Yeah, my thing with PLO would be I would look at a lot of the frequency stuff in terms of people's minimum defense frequencies in a lot of spots. And then obviously card removal is a huge part of this, but usually people would be defending enough in a lot of spots. And so I would just be winning $3 in EV here, $1 in EV there, $7 in EV there. And then I would just play like a $60,000 pot where I would do something really stupid. I don't know how many thousands of hands it would take to get back that one pot, but the big pots in PLO require some real understanding of the game that I never really quite got there with. I tried doing some, I bought Poker Ranger, which is up there for one of my worst purchases I've ever made, because, or Omaha Ranger, what was it called?
That doesn't ring a bell to me, honestly.
Poker Ranger, Omaha. What was the solver for Omaha that we had back in the day? Six years ago?
I don't even remember.
You were just too busy bossing it up. I don't need any of this solver shit. I'm just going to get in there and crush everybody anyway, huh?
I saw the trend towards kind of the solver-based play and realized, A, I'm kind of getting burnt out on this. B, this isn't as suited to my skill set as battling a little bit more of a feel-based game. And that was definitely something that helped quickly usher me out of poker.
Yeah, that makes sense. It does kind of take its toll over the years. And I think it takes a little bit of the fun out of the game when it becomes just who can log more hours. I've said this many times in this podcast, so I won't bore people with that. I did want to talk briefly about, was it called Let There Be Range? So the name of that book, the ebook. What was the idea there? Can you tell us about the story with that?
Sure. So Let There Be Range was a poker instructional ebook that was released in 2008, I believe. And it was something that I had been working on writing a poker book in general, kind of through first couple years of my career. One of the initial things that like helped me with poker strategy was reading poker books and the 2+2 poker forums. 2+2 is like the main poker book publisher. So my initial plan was to like write a book and try to get 2+2 to publish it and have, you know, more like a $25 book sitting on the shelves of Barnes & Noble, something like that. And at the time, I was playing a bunch against another player in the 10-20 party poker games. Guy's screen name was Slow Habit. Treewin is his name. And we were talking strategy, and I mentioned that I was working on this book. And he mentioned he was working on something similar, and that it'd be cool if we team forces. And he was definitely much more of the business side of this. Like, we kind of combined the book and worked on getting the content there together. And then his idea was to release this instead of as a $25 book on the shelf of Barnes & Noble through a publisher as a high-priced ebook. So it's like a $2,000 ebook. Honestly, I think like from a pricing structure, not all that dissimilar from, say, the course-based model that Upswing and a lot of poker instruction content has gone these days. Obviously, the content now is way more in-depth and high quality. This was 15 years ago. But yeah, I kind of left the business side of things in his hands to release it as a high-priced ebook. I think there are pros and cons to that. It was new for its time. It did reasonably well, but probably got some flack too for being the first kind of high-priced book of its kind.
How many units of that did you guys sell?
It's a good question. Like in the couple hundred range, I want to say.
Okay, that's pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that, I mean, I wouldn't have thought would have been that many. So first off, I got the book for free, not because I pirated it, but because I was a coach for you. You were my boss, Cole. And I never got a good job, Doug. What's up with that? No good job. No, I'm just kidding. Anyway, but Card Runners Pros, they got the book for free, right? I think all of the pros at some point, I don't know, down the road, they gave it to all of us. So I got to read through it. I think it's a little while afterwards. I can't say that I remember being really excited. I wish I could remember some of the excerpts or even still had it today so I could look at some of the stuff, but I was pretty shocked at the price point. And tying that into sort of talking about upswing and training today, there's certainly a curve where you have to think about trade-offs. And so, for example, if you charge $100 for poker training, people will rarely steal it from you. Obviously, people will always steal something at any price. But at $100, most people will just pay for the thing because they think it's good value, and it is good value for them. And then at $1,000, maybe you have more of a battle with that. And then if it was, let's say, $10,000, the vast majority of people would just steal it. So there's a lot of pricing kind of game theory as to what pricing makes the most sense. How much are you okay with people trying to steal your content? Because the content stealing game, I don't even know how many people we've gotten banned on various platforms trying to just take our stuff and sell it. It's whack-a-mole. You're always hitting one, hitting the other. But the main thing is you just want to try and do your best, because you do have paying members that you want to protect the information that they're getting, right? Because it's providing them value and they're paying for you, or paying for it. So I guess my question to you would be, in retrospect, what do you think about that price point versus if you had picked like $1,000 price point or something like that?
I guess the main takeaway from it for me was I wish I would have taken the time to have more input in it and to actually like think this through a bit better. At the time, I was still grinding tons of poker. I thought like I held up my end of the deal well, writing my part of the book, but I really did not think through this pricing model at all. The way it worked out, I was reasonably happy with. I don't know. I think at the time, at least, a lot of poker training content was significantly underpriced. Something like Card Runners, where it was $30 a month, they were on this kind of treadmill of releasing a video every single day, 99% of which, you know, didn't actually get many views. It was very tough as like a sustainable business model.
Are you trying to say that my 10 cent, 25 cent full ring videos on Card Runners weren't bringing home the bacon for the whole team?
That was probably part of the 1% that did get much views.
Yeah, maybe in retrospect, after I moved up in stakes. I mean, when I got the spot, I was actually a little bit surprised, because I guess I had a bit of a name because I had done some prop bets and MBG and stuff, but I wasn't some high stakes crusher when I joined Card Runners. I was just a small to mid stakes full ring guy that had kind of been signed on. One of the problems with the Card Runners content model, and a lot of other sites have done the same thing, I think Run It Once still does a lot of this to this day, it's just a lot of content, and it's difficult to keep out the churn where you have so many videos, and then you're obviously going to take a substantial hit on quality because you have to expand your team to have a lot of different coaches, and then you're also going to have more people that are managing and middlemen that are sort of just uploading and make sure everything gets in on time. So you incur a lot more cost and you lower the overall quality. And then also, you know, you can see the data when you own these training sites. You can see what percentage of videos people watch. They're not watching the vast, vast, vast majority of these. I can see the stuff in the Upswing lab. I don't know what it is today, but I think we have 250 hours in the lab or something like that. Might be more like 300 by now. And the average person is watching maybe 20% of that, you know, or 15% of that. And it's a lot. There's a small group of people that will watch every single video no matter what. And honestly, touche, well played on your part to just take every single video. And then you're going to have all of those guys. It's like when you sign up for a gym, right? Oh, I'm going to work out so hard. It's going to be awesome. Day two. And I'm not feeling it today. And then that's kind of it from there on out. So you can sort of see all the different people at play. Where I was taking this, I don't. Actually, I want to ask you this. I want to talk about going into the business side. So was this sort of your first foray into the business side? I forget what that was, probably after Card Runners had already launched, right? So at what point did you realize that you were kind of more interested in the business side of poker?
Well, I definitely always enjoyed teaching just in general. So I think that was kind of what led me to, you know, write Let There Be Range, get involved with Card Runners. And then Card Runners kind of opened the door to networking in the business side of poker. So we also bought Hold'em Manager, you know, one of the biggest pieces of poker software. And you know, gotten some kind of unrelated poker business deals as well. So yeah, I'd say that's kind of what opened the door for me.
Did you work a lot with Taylor Cabe in those days? I assume.
Yeah, quite a bit at the time. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Yeah, he was another guy we had in this podcast, guys.
Yeah, I listened to it. Yeah, it was a good one.
Yeah. Did you respond and say like Dinosaurs of Poker on our Dinosaurs of Poker tour or whatever on Twitter?
Yeah, you had quite the run.
Yeah, quite the run indeed. Okay, so I think that kind of wraps up most of the poker related stuff that I prepared for you today. Although you did manage to get out of saying how much you'd want in your poker career. That's okay. We'll leave our guests wondering. And we're going to jump in with some more stuff. But before we do, guys, today's podcast is brought to you by CoinFlex. CoinFlex is a crypto futures exchange which sees over $2 billion in daily trading volume. And you know what, guys? I'm going totally off script now. I'm just going to talk about CoinFlex. Look, CoinFlex has something called FlexUSD. It's a stablecoin that earns you money simply by having it, by holding it in your account. I have some of my own money in FlexUSD. It makes about 12% a year. The way that it makes that money is there's a repo market on CoinFlex people can use, and then the fees they pay are passed on to you, okay? Every FlexUSD is backed at a 1-to-1 ratio by USDC, redeemable at any time, so you can get your money in and out of USDC whenever you want. And look, I'm going to be honest with you on this, guys. 12% a year on stablecoins is pretty good. If you're a DeFi wizard, can you make more? Yes, you can make more. But there are two things that I like about this. First off, you're going to be hopping protocols a bunch. Rates will drop. You're going to have to deal with gas. You're going to have to deal with change. You can do all this work. And maybe you get a higher rate. Maybe you don't. That's the first thing. And then second off, there's a lot of security here because every dollar is backed to 1-to-1 by USDC. You can mint. You can redeem at any time by burning your FlexUSD for USDC. I think this is a great option for you if you want a low-risk investing option. Yes, the returns are only going to be 12% compared to 1,000,000%. You're going to get farming some bakery token. However, it's real money. It's stable. And I'm invested this in some myself. And I do have to give this caveat at the end. Legal disclaimer, none of the information contained here constitutes an offer to buy or sell any currency, product, or financial instrument to make any investment or to participate in any particular trading strategy. Okay. It's off the cuff on that one, Cole. I feel like I read it too many times. It's time to mix it up.
Nicely done.
So
you got to get in the bakery tokens. You
know? The bakery tokens. I mean, you have to get the bakery tokens or you don't. Okay, so let's talk about crypto stuff. I'm pretty sure that you have been involved for a good number of years. And I think that I heard someone told me that you had said this either in a podcast or a post somewhere that on 2+2, you kind of had stumbled across some of the stuff that people were talking about when it came to cryptocurrencies. So what year did you first find out about cryptocurrency? Where did you find out about it?
Oh, man. So I think my initial exposure to Bitcoin was in 2+2's Business Finance and Investing Forum. And there was a Bitcoin thread there that...
An epic thread.
Yeah, huge thread. And that was the issue because I feel like I usually stayed up to date on those threads, but I was on like vacation for a week and I come back and the thread is like 7 pages long. I'm like, this sounds like a little technically complicated. I'm just going to skip this one, you know? That was a huge mistake because some of the guys in the thread were talking about like buying up 1% of the supply of all Bitcoin and stuff like that, which at the time was like 50 cents a coin. When I actually started using it was when I started playing poker on Seals with Clubs. Seals with Clubs was an early Bitcoin poker site. And at the time, I was purely using Bitcoin as a fiat on and off ramp. I don't know why. I never really thought about like, hey, this is a cool thing to like learn about and like gamble on as well. But at the time, I was strictly concerned with, hey, there are good poker games on this site. The games in, you know, if you convert all the Bitcoin to dollars for like 50, 100 PLO or something. So I'm just going to buy a bunch of Bitcoin on Coinbase or Circle at the time. And play poker on Seals with Clubs with it.
This sounds like an exact mirror of my story, which is I stumbled across it a bit. I kind of knew about it. And then I started using it. Well, mine was actually twofold. First off was to get money in and out of different poker places. I also had some banking issues, so it kind of gave me a little flexibility. And then also there were dice sites where you could invest as the house and be the bankroll and people would gamble against your money. And, you know, being the house is nice. So I decided to invest in these bankrolls. And not only did I win a bunch of Bitcoin there, it appreciated while it was good. Probably to this day, the best investment that I ever made because it was just the dual pronged effect of having Bitcoin going up in value while you're making Bitcoin was a pretty lethal double threat.
Nice.
Did you invest in any of those, the dice sites back in the day?
No, I remember hearing about them, like Satoshi Dice and stuff. But
Satoshi Dice, Just Dice, Doge Dice. I was looking at my logs. I have these Doge transfers from 2014 where I'm just moving tens of millions of Doge back and forth. You know, I should have held.
Never sell anything. That's the moral of the story.
Yeah, that's definitely the takeaway here is never sell anything. So, okay, so you saw it in that thread. By the way, I've read a bunch of those threads in the business, finance, and investing portion 2+2. There's some really epic stuff. There's a great real estate thread as well for people that are thinking about real estate. The Bitcoin thread is funny because it's bulls versus bears for a while. and then it's still Bulls versus Bears. And then by the end, it's still Bulls versus Bears, but the price has gone up 100 or 200x from the starting conversation or more. I guess it was probably more like 500 to 1,000x now that I think about it.
Yeah.
It's incredible. There's a real overlap between poker and crypto, where there are a bunch of poker people that were either between decent to great poker players that got into cryptocurrency quite early for, you know, either one of the reasons that we did, or maybe they were just smart, unlike us, and they just thought this is going to be awesome, and they just got in from day one. I don't know, but there really seems to be a lot of wealth that's been built up in the poker community by the rise of cryptocurrency, and I guess it's kind of cool just to see a lot of people that I've worked with in poker and seen play, see the success of everyone. Obviously, there are a lot of guys that got a business as well, but the overlap of poker and crypto is pretty incredible.
Well, yeah, you need the kind of like this fringe overlap of skill sets, from like being okay doing kind of wacky stuff on the internet to like some odd economic views to like wanting to gamble a bunch too, because the price on this thing goes all over the place, to like high appetite for risk. And I feel like being a poker pro covered your bases in at least a few of those. I feel like I didn't really have maybe the economic or the technical interest in Bitcoin. And that's maybe why for those first few years, I really treated it purely as a vehicle to play online poker.
Once you realized, oh shit, this is a thing, and you saw the value was increasing, did you do what a lot of people did and started to dabble in a lot of the altcoins, or did you mainly stay pretty BTC centric?
Yeah, it's true. Certainly have my, you know, wallets full of dusty Rye blocks or, you know.
Or Pastel.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Shout out to Pastel, which,
sometimes,
you know, one day.
Strategy is just, you know, hard to beat.
I must be the only person in the world that got into NFTs in 2017 and thought, guys, I got it. Okay, we're going to build a platform for NFTs. Not let's buy all the NFTs that are currently worth dust. No, let's make a platform and a currency based around it. And that sounds great. And then, you know, obviously I'm stuck six figures somehow. It's just so tilting. You know what's tilting about that? What's tilting about that is I fucking saw this on the wall. I said, this is going to be big. I believe in this. I'm going to invest my money in this. And then the end result is, well, we never know. Maybe Pastel pans out one day. Who knows? But why didn't I just buy punks? Why didn't I just buy some cool shit? Now. So stupid.
You have like a fraction of a punk now, right?
I don't think
so.
Well, okay. So I'm thinking about, let me think about my language carefully here. Yes, I own a fraction of a punk. I may or may not own a fraction of a punk because it's part of a group of people where stuff is happening. I'll leave it at that. I might still have a fraction of a punk. I'm not sure. I'd have to get my updates from my guy, but
Save that for a future podcast.
Yeah. So NFTs, what are your thoughts on the current market? Are you invested in any of the big projects?
No, I mean, I own just kind of like a couple blue chips. I think the space is super interesting. I do think that one thing that like being a poker player teaches you is to think of like a variety of outcomes and expected value. And a lot of times when you talk to people, you know, that don't come from the poker or gambling world about NFTs, they have this very like binary, like it's a JPEG, it's going to zero. Or, you know, this market is the best thing ever. It's just going to be up only forever. So I wouldn't say I have like extreme conviction in like any of the NFTs I own. But I do think that it's a neat overlap of gambling, trading, deal making, art, collecting, and something that's been enjoyable to, you know, collect a little bit and learn about. But it's not like the focus of my crypto portfolio by any means.
I like the way that you put that. I do think that there is a battle emerging between NFTs that make sense in terms of their scarcity and their significance, so something like a CryptoPunk, and then NFTs that are saying, hey, we're going to figure out ways to just pummel value at you to make this thing increase in value, something more like a Bored Ape Yacht Club. I don't know why I can't pronounce that. Or a V Friends, not quite as much value there, but still on that kind of side of the strategy. And it's kind of interesting to me because one of the things that I like about CryptoPunks as an example is they're just so straightforward. This is it. We're not going to get you tickets to some concert. You're not getting a kickback. You're not getting in for some sneakers. You're not going, you know what I'm saying? We're not going to give you supplemental art that backs this up. it just is what it is. You can take it or you can leave it. And I kind of love that. Once NFTs get into this, we'll give you this, we'll give you that, we'll give you this. And maybe that's the future of NFTs, where they're heading. Really, your NFT represents some kind of value that you're going to be given back. And maybe that makes more sense. But it starts to feel gimmicky to me. Because now, why are we using an NFT to have this represent just this value that you're going to be getting back? Why does this need to be an NFT?
Yeah, I think in general, like, community is a liability and not an asset for most NFTs. It's different if it's something like VFriends and like this is, hey, your conference ticket and Gary Vee is someone that you just like really want to support. I actually think that like for, you know, that's a project that's gotten shit on a bunch by like the crypto OG community. I think it's a really interesting one.
Well, the problem with that one is the royalties. It's a 10% royalty. Come, dude, 10%.
Yeah, but I mean, is it really designed to be traded, flipped, and made money on? Or is this, you know, something that is designed to be a less liquid asset? I don't know.
If it wasn't designed to be traded and made money on, then why do they have a 10% royalty?
Well, I think it encourages it, you know?
I think that what they're doing is they realize these are going to be actively traded and highly speculated on. And so having a 10% royalty is going to make them a lot of money. And it just seems very greedy to me. You could have a royalty. I think most people are okay with some amount of kickback to the original artist. But when you have a 10% royalty, it's a pretty unsufferable amount of rake to have on these transactions. It pained me. When I bought them, I hated my... It was my first NFT. I said, okay, here we go. And I closed my eyes and I clicked buy and I felt disgust. I had to take a cold shower afterwards, you know, just to kind of wash off the filth of buying some VFriends. And I think I almost doubled my money or made 70% or something like that. I forget the exact number after the fees and stuff, but didn't feel good about it.
In general, I think it's like a really interesting space with interesting technology. What makes me nervous about it is that when you talk to people about NFTs, they either think they're worthless or they think they're going to flip their way into riches by trading up the OpenSea volume charts. And I think that like that kind of getting rich flipping NFTs mindset is just a recipe for disaster. If you look at like the OpenSea volume, the volume is just so unsustainable, where like of the top 10 collections, they're all brand new ones that launch and within a week of mint have, you know, 6 ETH floor prices. I just don't think that this is a market that can sustain new collections and the amount of supply that's coming to market that quickly.
I guess the counter argument to that would be, this is the first thing that I think normal people can kind of understand. And I know that it's a funny thing to say because normal people are also saying this is a JPEG, but normal people kind of understand that art is already kind of stupid. And so seriously, right? I've said this before on this podcast, why not have this art be, oh, the NFT is stupid. Well, your art is stupid. Art's pretty stupid overall. I mean, I like art, some nice pieces. It seems like you have a nice couple pieces in the background here. No offense to your art you have in the background. But overall, art's kind of silly and it's really subjective and it's up to what people feel, right? It really, the value of it is how you feel about the piece, what it represents, where it's from, how many there are, all that kind of stuff. So is it really that much more silly to be an NFT? And I think, like, especially celebrities, I just recorded a video on this. It's going to come out next week for my crypto channel, where I make fun of a bunch of celebrities that promote this stuff because the community stuff is just unbearable. There was this interview with Paris Hilton on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon. Did you see this?
No.
Oh my God. It's just brutal to have to sit through. I don't watch it. But basically they talk about their apes and how their apes are like them. And I'm just, it's brutal to see. But one thing, whether they're just trying to scam their followers or not, celebrities seem to really like NFTs in a way that we didn't see for different layer one solutions. I'm not seeing.
Sure. I mean, it's good onboarding into crypto. It's simple. There's not like this complex, you know, technology you got to understand to purchase something on OpenSea.
You're not going to see Mike Tyson with a Avalanche logo as his profile picture, right? It's going to be some NFT or it's NBA players, NFL players, whatever. So it is a good on-ramp. And I guess to finalize the thought I started on before that long-winded rant, if it can onboard people like that in a way that other cryptocurrencies have not, maybe it can be kind of sustainable. Not all the projects. Obviously, most of these are going to become dust. But maybe if you can onboard that effectively, maybe you can sustain a lot of these projects.
Yeah, I think the jury's out. And I'm glad it's onboarding people into crypto in general. I'm just hesitant if the reason it's onboarding them is because they think they're going to get rich flipping them.
Well, people, when you buy your NFT, you're not in it for the tech.
Yeah.
All right, so NFTs. You didn't actually see, you said you have a crypto punk, or you might be. You said a couple blue chips, so that means apes and punks. Sounds like.
Yeah, like I haven't really done. I messed around with kind of newer stuff, but like I focus more on the older kind of established projects and stuff I kind of like too.
Are you in the Ether Rock streets?
Yeah, a little bit.
You're in the Ether Rock streets. Nice, very nice. Yeah, those are probably peak people getting angry that people are buying them.
Well, I think that's very much like a similar type of NFT that you're talking about, like with punks, where there's no promise here. Like, sure, there's a Telegram chat or whatever with the rock holders, but there's no like, this isn't a income generating asset or something that you're gonna like get monetary value out of.
That sounds like a great group chat. What do you guys talk about day to day?
Gotta keep that private.
Okay, that makes sense. All right. Okay, so let's talk about some DeFi stuff. Recently, you did, I mean, maybe just crypto in general stuff here. Recently, you did a series where you basically teach people from the ground up how to use cryptocurrency, how to do so safely. What was kind of your idea with that, and where are you planning on taking that?
Yeah, so basically, I've been involved in crypto for a long time, and friends both from poker as well as non-poker friends have just asked me, hey, how do I get involved with this? How do I learn about it? And each time I've kind of made them a series of just kind of Loom videos recording, hey, this is how to get set up. This is how not to donk your stack off in these five different common ways, and how to get started like interacting with crypto apps. And I've been asked to do this a bunch of different times and still see people like in my Twitter feed that like get their board ape stolen or something like that. So I decided to just make all these videos like once and for all in like a kind of better production value way and just put them up for free. So created a website, coins.fyi, where I put up these videos kind of showing you how to set up a hardware wallet to protect your crypto assets and some basics of kind of OPSEC around that, and then how to get involved with NFTs, DeFi, other Ethereum-based crypto apps. And as far as what's the plan with it, there is no plan. I just put up these videos so I can send friends to them. It's not monetized. Will it be more? I don't know. It was a ton of work, man. I have a lot of respect for what you're doing here because it was a ton of work.
So really what you're saying is this was just your way of not having to do this over and over again for different people.
That was the original idea. Yeah. And I thought it would be useful for people in general, but there wasn't like some hidden business plan of like a super secret $2,000 upsell ebook at the end of it or anything. That's for sure.
Well, that's very kind of you. And I also appreciate you saying it's hard work to make content because it definitely is. It takes a lot. So it's not easy. All the tech stuff, just making sure everything looks good, sounds good, presented in the right way. Luckily we have a pretty low bar for what qualifies as content around here. So that helps out, but definitely guys, if you're new to crypto or you're considering thinking about crypto and look, I know a lot of people in this podcast were primarily a poker audience. We do have some crypto overlap. Of course, I know there's a lot of guys that are definitely out on crypto or they don't like crypto, but I do think that if you're just writing it off because you've always disliked crypto, then you're doing yourself a disservice to some of the opportunities that might be available to you. And it can't hurt to learn. So if you're new to the crypto streets or you're thinking about it or maybe you just want to see what it's all about, I definitely recommend checking. You said coins.fyi?
Yep. I think like the big thing that I try to hammer home in these videos is like, this is not like an investment course, a money-making course, get rich quick thing. This is just to learn about, you know, what the latest technology is in crypto. Like expect to lose money in this because we're doing most of this on the Ethereum network where fees are high. So like I really try to hammer home that point. Like don't go into this thinking that you're going to make any money. Think of this as a learning experience. You're going to learn about how NFTs work, how DeFi works, that sort of stuff. There were a couple of cool things where like one of the things we did was register an ENS domain name. And 2 weeks later, there was the ENS token airdrop. So everyone who followed that video ended up getting an airdrop that was worth like, I think 20K at its peak.
And wow.
One of the people that did it was an 8-year-old kid.
I said, wow.
Yeah. That he got this, sick. You know, 20K ENS airdrop.
Why? Can you explain this airdrop to me? Like why was your video? Why was that chosen? How did this money exist?
Yeah. So sure. ENS is Ethereum name service. So it's basically like a domain name. So instead of like upswingpoker.com, you could register the ENS name upswingpoker.eth. And if you wanted to say collect membership fees, instead of typing in some super long 40-character address that starts with 0x and a bunch of gobbledygook, they could just type in upswing.eth. And the ENS domain name service was basically a DAO, an organization that you were paying registration fees, just like you would if you were registering a domain name on GoDaddy or whatever, and they were collecting those fees. Well, the ENS domain name service basically it started to decentralize. So instead of being like a centralized service, they airdropped ENS tokens to anyone who had registered a domain a name with ENS.
I see. Okay, so it wasn't that your community specifically got this drop. It was anyone with the ENS domain. I mean, obviously, I know about the ENS domains. Mm-hmm. I've seen a bunch of people with them. So that's awesome. So anyone that followed your series made 20K at the peak.
Yeah, but again, like the idea behind this is to like learn about it and like not treat it as a money making endeavor. And then once you have an idea of the fundamentals, then maybe you can think about how, hey, I could turn this into an investment vehicle or figure out how to, you know, earn income doing this. But I think it's important to have a solid fundamental basis for that.
What's a more authentic way to learn about crypto than to get into it, not trying to make money and then end up making 20K? I can't think of something more authentic. That's a great introduction to the community.
Yeah, it was cool to see.
That's awesome that you did that to help people, though. That'll provide a great service for people. A couple questions here. Let's change gears in this conversation. So you just mentioned ETH gas. Ethereum gas is completely ridiculous. It's gotten a little better lately, mainly because Ethereum price has gone down. Do you have a take on the future of Ethereum versus some of these alternative layer ones like Solana or Avalanche or Polygon? Or you could there's like 15. You could just keep going on and on. Do you have a take on that?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, ETH gas is really expensive right now, and it's making the network unusable and priced out for a wide variety of users. I do sort of feel like this is like complaining about not being able to stream Netflix in 1997, where it's like, yeah, the technology is not quite ready for it. But like, if you see the big picture here, in 20 years, everybody's going to be watching 4K TV on their wall, you know, on any internet connection. I think when it comes to Ethereum in general, really smart people are working on trying to upgrade the Ethereum network. And a decent like framework for thinking about this is actually our good friend Haseeb Qureshi, old poker name, but he's big like kind of crypto investor influencer now. And he always talks about like Ethereum and blockchains in general as like the cities model, where Ethereum is like Manhattan. And there are a few upgrades going on. First is upgrading Ethereum itself to Ethereum 2.0. It's going to move from proof of work to proof of stake, add in some additional just kind of upgrades on like the core of Ethereum. You think of that as like adding like a few extra boroughs around Manhattan, Queens, Staten Island and stuff. Second would be like rollups. And rollups are like building skyscrapers where a bunch of users can package their transaction and basically split the fees, kind of building up on Ethereum. And then third is like sidechains or competing L1s, other layer one solutions like Avalanche, Solana and stuff. That'd be basically like another city, like Avalanche being Chicago or something like that. And you can have a bridge from Manhattan, Ethereum to Avalanche, Chicago, that helps users move money around. And maybe for like core, super valuable financial transactions, you need to do those in Manhattan. But for something else, you might go to Chicago. Or maybe there's like an NFT city, LA, that's its own kind of L1. And like people do NFT activity over there. So I think that's like one way people are thinking about this, that the combination of rollups and cross-chain bridges is going to be a big scaling solution. I think one thing that like seems clear to me is that no one blockchain is going to be the answer to this. There's just going to be so much demand for block space and the use of this technology that it doesn't matter how strong the throughput of your chain is and how many transactions per second it can do. Like a monolithic blockchain where it's just one blockchain processing everything is not going to be the answer here. So I do think it's going to look something more like that. Or Cosmos and Polkadot have kind of like a little bit of a different twist on this, where they have application-specific blockchains. So on Cosmos, for example, Osmosis is their main exchange, and that is its own blockchain. That's like all it does. So you do your exchanges there, and then you can kind of bridge over to a different application-specific blockchain if you wanted to, say, buy some NFTs or something like that. So those are like the two ways that I see that smart people think that this is going to play out. I'm not exactly sure what the future is going to look like, but in general, I'm probably more bullish on Ethereum than anything else. I think that super secure, strong, decentralized main layer is kind of the hardest aspect of all this to reproduce. Like if Ethereum gets these ZK rollups that can process tons of transactions really cheaply, sure, Solana can implement that exact same technology. But I think what Solana or other competitors are going to have a hard time replicating is Ethereum's decentralization and security.
Definitely. And you make sacrifices. It's the trilemma problem. You have to make sacrifices somewhere to get benefits elsewhere. And eventually, you just have to make some core decisions as to what's important to you as a project. And for example, with Bitcoin, security and decentralization have been number one above everything else. And that's why the tech hasn't been upgraded very quickly, because they're saying, look, we want this to make sure that it works no matter what. We're the store of value. We're the secure. We're the store of value, basically, currency here. So we're not going to have any chance of any risk whatsoever. Yeah, that's going to be slow, or it's going to take a while to roll things out. That's fine. I think when we look at ETH 2.0 and the roadmap for that, it kind of goes two different ways. And I think that how ETH 2.0 rollout happens, and I know they're moving away from that language. I know Vitalik has been want to move away from the ETH 2.0 thing. It's kind of a meme at this point. But basically, it boils down to one of two things. Either it's going to go fairly successfully and relatively at the right timelines, or it's not. And if it does, then these other blockchains, yes, they might still have a purpose down the road, but the reality is if Ethereum can implement sharding the way that they've said that they're going to try to implement sharding, the fees will drop so substantially that, yeah, you're still going to need other blockchains to have certain functions and uses. But the reality is that the reason that these values are rising so significantly for these alternative chains is that they are saying, hey, we're going to compete with Ethereum here for the same market share. If ETH 2.0 can successfully move over to sharding and solve these problems that they're trying to solve, then the reality is that a lot of this value that's currently being captured by alternative layer ones, I don't think is going to sustain itself. So I don't see the same types of, if the day comes where the Ethereum 2.0 successfully launches, it's going to be a bad day for these alternative layer ones. I would imagine. I think the more interesting question is, what happens if things get delayed, if it doesn't work well? My friend Jason Moe, he loves memeing about ETH 2.0 and, oh, it's going to be great, guys. Just, you know, all we need is a revolution in computer science. It's all we need. It's just, he just goes on and on with it. It's pretty outstanding. But if we don't see this happen on a reasonable time scale or timeline in line with what they've been saying we're going to see in some of these deadlines, then it starts to make this question of, well, okay, everyone knows Ethereum is the main decentralized protocol. I mean, it's the second biggest coin. Ether is the second biggest coin out there. Obviously, it has the most money behind it. Obviously, it's the most decentralized, all these things. But if they can't get transactions under $100 to do anything, it kind of doesn't matter, because you just price out so many people. And I know what people will say as the counter to that is, okay, well, look at the fees generated by blockchain, right? Here's Ethereum's. It's 30 million a day or whatever it is. The next highest is 1 million. And that's a relatively good argument, because people are willing to spend that much money to be able to use the chain, right? However, if it gets to a point where you can't use it cost efficiently and it's only a few people that are actually using the chain, there people are going to find other solutions. And it's why Binance Smart Chain has had so many users and it's the most actively used chain. People don't realize that Binance Smart Chain, I think I was listening to Uncommon Core. It's a great podcast if you guys want to check it out. Binance Smart Chain is the most used smart contract chain for basically EVM. And the reason is because it costs cents to do these transactions, these DeFi transactions. Well, if you're not actually onboarding users and you're not actually growing the amount of people that want to use your chain, what does that look like for you down the road? Maybe it's fine today, but is that true tomorrow? So I guess I don't really feel that strongly on either side of that, but I do think that there is an argument to be made that the direction that Ethereum is headed could potentially be a lot more negative than I think that most people in the space seem to think.
I also think that there's a big factor that's not only with fees, but the idea that like new entrants to crypto feel like they've missed Ethereum, and that, hey, I don't owe anything to these crypto OGs interacting on Ethereum. I just saw Avalanche do 100x this year, and there's this other competing Ethereum competitor that's, you know, in the number 200 on CoinMarketCap or whatever. I'm gonna invest in that one, do my activity over there, because not only is it cheap, but I'm kind of getting in on the ground floor of that one, and I'm gonna have to hold some of its native token to do transactions. Maybe I'll get rich doing that.
Yeah, and you might.
Yeah.
Whereas
you're all this year. That was your investment thesis.
Sorry, say that again.
I mean, the whole kind of Ethereum competitor narrative for the past year has been super strong. You know, Avalanche, Phantom, Luna, Solana, just everything has been crushing that's been trying to compete with Ethereum.
Yeah, my strategy has been basically my biggest holds are Bitcoin and Ethereum. And then I try to just get some exposure to all of these other big layer ones. There's a couple that I'm not. I miss the Luna thing. I don't love the way they're handling UST. I just that one I'm not in on, but most of the other bigger L1s I have like some small amount of exposure to, because if things go badly with Ethereum, that's okay, because someone else will crush then, and I'll have exposure to all these other ones that are the main kind of players that would take market cap from Ethereum. And if Ethereum crushes, I'm happy. It's my second biggest hold, or it's roughly what I have in Bitcoin. So it's not like I'm anti-Ethereum over here or something. I can already see people just going, like, Ethereum's the best. I like Ethereum. Ethereum's been good to me. I have no problem with Ethereum, but
I don't view it as a totally zero-sum game. Like, I think if ETH does pull off the migration to all the upgrades that they have in the works, I don't think that means that Avalanche is going to zero overnight or anything like that. I do think that this space in general is going to grow so much, and there's going to be so much demand for block space and this technology in general, that it can be somewhat of a rising tide lifts all boats, even if Ethereum executes perfectly.
Are there any alternative layer ones and or protocols that you're passionate about these days that you enjoy? Or where are you farming, Cool?
No, not really.
Where are the crops at?
Honestly, I feel like I don't really have any super strong conviction outside of anything, outside of Ethereum. And so I'm hesitant to even mention anything else, especially because my opinion changes day to day so fast. So like, I don't want to say, hey, I like coin X, where 1% of my portfolio is in coin X. Someone goes all in on it. I decide I want to get out tomorrow, and they've gotten wrecked and think that I was to blame for it, you know? I kind of steer away from that.
So we, okay. Well, that's you're taking the high road.
I feel like Ethereum, like I could, you know, have my Ethereum balance, go into a coma for 5 or 10 years, and feel like pretty confident that when I came out, I would be doing well.
That's a safe bet.
I don't feel like I have that conviction about anything else I hold on to.
So Bitcoin then, is Bitcoin the dinosaur coin? Is it done? Is it over? The old man's coin?
No, I would just say it's like competing to win a different battle. You know, it's like almost trying to become this asset, like it's macro asset rather than a technology play. And I have a harder time wrapping my head around how exactly that's going to play out and the supply and demand and the market forces there. It's not something that I understand all that well and feel like I have any sort of edge in. Whereas Ethereum, I feel like can be treated more as like a tech investment and seeing where the technology is going, where users are putting their assets, spending their money. I feel like that is a more like a logical step play to this accruing value than Bitcoin for me.
Yeah, I guess I see what you're saying. Basically, there's just more utility. And so whereas with Bitcoin, it just kind of has to be more speculation because it's just trying to be store of value. It's not trying to do things. It's not trying to be a currency. It's not trying to be a decentralized platform. It's just Bitcoin. But the weird thing is, though, its backstory and the fact that how it was created, the fact it's the first, the fact it's been the strongest, the fact that it has such a strong community of people that support it, it also feels very safe to me. And I know it's the boring play, but I still think it's a very good one. Like if I had to go in a coma today, and in fact, if I had to pick my currency, I had to go in a coma today, I had to put it all in one currency, what would I pick if I had to pick it? I think I would pick Bitcoin over Ethereum.
Yeah, I mean, Craig Wright did a good job making it. It's fundamentally sound. You know?
Oh, God.
I'm not bearish Bitcoin by any means. I just, I feel like for me, like a logical progression for ETH, continuing to appreciate makes more sense. And also, I think there's a strong argument in that, particularly in DeFi right now, there are a lot of ways to earn yield on your ETH that don't exist for Bitcoin unless you're wrapping it and using it on the Ethereum network. And if you're taking like two different assets where one is just sitting there and the other is productive, especially if you're looking at a 10-year time frame and one's, you know, earning 7% staking rewards for ETH, for example, it's going to double in that 10-year period. So you really have to have a lot of conviction that the other one's going to like outperform if it's not producing anything.
That's a fair point. You're talking about the ETH pods, right?
Basically, like if you wanted to stake ETH on Coinbase right now, you know, okay, it's going to be locked up until the merge from proof of work to proof of stake and be earning somewhere between like 5% and 7%.
Yeah, I got a taste in those pods as well. JMO berates me for that all the time. he shows me what it's trading at compared to just ETH and then just like insults me.
Well, I mean, technology is kind of heading towards like liquid staking. So you stake your ETH, but you get this staked ETH token that then you can go ahead and use in DeFi and that sort of thing.
Lido. I think that's
clearly like where the technology is going to go.
Yeah, that's certainly true.
If you're locked up until the merge with your ETH on Coinbase, like, yeah, not good.
Yeah. Well, here we are. Hopefully we make it out. My hope there is if there were big tech problems that it would become a little more centralized and someone would step in and save us. That's my, I mean, it's happened before on Ethereum.
Yeah. I mean, it worked for Solana last week. They had that huge hack where, you know, several hundred million dollars of ETH backing the wrapped ETH on Solana disappeared. And within a matter of hours, some kind of centralized market makers had jumped in and restocked the account.
It's weird with that kind of stuff. There's certainly, there are amounts of money when you steal some. So, okay, let me give you a tip out there for all your upcoming hackers. If you're trying to get a big payday, aim for something like 5 to 15 million, maybe 20. No one's going to give two shits. They're just going to chalk that up to variance. But if you come and you steal anything in the 9-figure range, you're getting blacklisted all over the place. Everyone's gonna check your IPs and any account you ever had. USDT is gonna, they have a way to prevent you from being able to transfer the stable coins, I think. You're gonna have all of these different chains stepping in. Everyone's gonna try and, it's just too much money. People have to care. So just make sure you steal about 10 million. You'll be good to go.
Did you see the news about the Bitfinex hack that was recovered today?
I just saw that. Yeah, I saw that before.
It's going to be a good Doug Polk crypto video. The two people that they caught with the money looked like some interesting characters.
I saw the video of the girl, right?
Well, he's got a whole YouTube channel. There's hours and hours of footage to go through. Yeah.
Oh, wow. That story, for those of you guys that have not heard about this, they apparently stole something like $70 million-ish in I think, Bitcoin, right? Or 120K, whatever it was, from many, many years ago. And then we're sort of forced to hold on to it, and it had become worth $3.6 billion. And yep. They have now recovered the funds from these two, right? Or have they recovered the funds, or did they just arrest them?
No, it sounds like they've recovered the funds they were somehow storing the private keys in some sort of cloud account. It's unclear if these two people are actually the hackers that have this $4 billion of Bitcoin, or if they were being used as money launderers or what. But I think it's going to be an interesting story however it shakes out.
How do you have $4 billion on the cloud? Can we just talk about that for a second? Would that be approved in the Cole South crypto use tutorial videos? You've got $4 billion on the cloud. It's incredible.
Yeah.
I hate cloud services, by the way. Not to sound like, you know, an old man again, but whenever there's a cloud option, I remove it. And then sometimes it tries to force you to use the cloud, or it'll sneakily upload your stuff. And I said, no. I don't want the cloud. I want it stored locally. All my data being sent around to governments prying into my business.
Fair enough.
All right. Okay. All right. So,
like a true Bitcoiner.
True Bitcoiner. Yeah. Not your keys, not your Bitcoin. Actually, I saw a good thread on Reddit about that recently, where basically people were saying that's kind of an old school way of looking at things. Because if you look at the bigger exchanges nowadays, you look at a Coinbase, you look at a Coinflex. Perhaps your money is going to be in good hands on these platforms, and it's very unlikely that the big platforms that have a lot of volume are going to be going down and stealing your money. I mean, what's the chance that crypto.com just goes under and your money is gone? Or in fact, I bet with most of these sites, if money is stolen, then they'll just cover the user funds. Didn't that happen with a bigger exchange somewhat recently?
Yep, it's happened a bunch. I mean, I think if you're not trying to do anything with your crypto, that's certainly what I'd recommend. Keep your coins on Coinbase or FTX, turn on two-factor authentication, and use the whitelist withdraw function, where you can only withdraw to an address that's added to your whitelist. And if somebody gets access to your account somehow and they try to add their own Ethereum address to withdraw everything to, you get an email notification first, and then there's a 7-day waiting period for you to contact them and be like, hey, my account was compromised. Do not send any crypto to that address. Because the issue is, any crypto withdrawal is just going to be completely unreversible. But yeah, I think the main exchanges, if you're not trying to do anything with your crypto, are plenty safe.
Fair enough. Good point. I want to wrap up today where I get some free value here from Cole, because I recently launched a self-tanner brand with my wife, Naru Organics. We have a organic, naturally derived ingredient, self-tanner. It's by far and away the best product in the market, by the way, for the 98.8% men that are listening right now. Feel free if you're trying to tan up for the summer. Regardless, so we started selling a couple weeks ago, and a month or two ago, Cole actually had a call with me, and he walked me through some of the e-commerce basics. What's your background with e-commerce? How did you first get involved?
Sure. So my wife and I moved to San Diego in 2015, and we had some good friends here actually through poker. And my buddy Dave, who became a business partner, he and I would walk our dogs around Fiesta Island here each morning, just kind of kicking around business ideas. At that time, poker was in a pretty steep decline, especially for Americans, where I had an office in Mexico and was coming back and forth a bunch. It was a huge pain to continue to play poker. And we were both kind of looking for something new. So one of the ideas we were kicking around was a new brand of baby shoes. Super random. But Dave had two young kids at the time, and his wife was really kind of tilted with the baby shoe options. They were either like super nice $60 shoes that your kid outgrows really quick or throws up on and throws out the window and loses, or like $5 drop shipped straight from China in a dirty plastic bag that you feel like sketchy putting on your kid. It's like, I wonder if we can do kind of a middle of the road option here. And we launched a brand of baby shoes, Bird Rock Baby, with super high quality shoes, like backed by an American company with really rigorous safety testing standards and a strong product guarantee. And initially it was just a side project. We launched this on Amazon. And for the first year, sales kind of started organically picking up a little bit. I think more importantly than that, customers just really like the product. Like if you look at them now, got several thousand five-star reviews on Amazon, like bestseller, really, just really proud of the product. But after that first year, it had picked up enough traction that we decided we'd jump into this full time and that we try to launch several different brands around things that Dave and I do on a daily basis. So we launched a Brazilian jiu-jitsu brand selling jiu-jitsu gis, uniforms, stuff like that, gold BJJ, and launched three other brands as well, two of which we sold. The third we're actually in the process of selling right now. So yeah, we have this operation for our baby brand and our jiu-jitsu brand. It's a kind of oddly traditional business for someone with a poker background. Got an office here in San Diego with roughly 15 people working on different aspects of the business. And yeah, it's been a fun little adventure.
That's super impressive that you managed to just jump into that and crush it there. So you started have you started any that didn't succeed?
So the three that we've sold, I'd say one of them was like a solid double or triple as far as like selling it. And then the other two were kind of small sales where we just wanted to get them off of our plate. There's a very active market for buying and selling e-commerce businesses right now. There's several kind of aggregators that have raised billions of dollars to buy small and medium-sized e-commerce businesses like ours. So it was a natural kind of fit to exit a few of them. I think when we originally started the business, we're like, all right, we're going to learn these processes and launch a bunch of brands with the same processes. And then we got up to five brands. We're like, man, I wish we would have just done one or two and kind of gone deep rather than gone wide. So over the next couple of years, we sold off three of them. And then the plan is to kind of keep these two, keep the options open. But we really just enjoy running these two brands because, you know, our kids are the models. I train jiu-jitsu every morning, wear our gear. They're just kind of fun business to run.
Yeah, that's awesome. You found spots where there was a gap in the market and you took advantage of that. I guess maybe I'm jaded when it comes to gaps in market. So like with our product, Caitlin complains about this all the time before we had our product that there wasn't a good organic self-tanner. I'd had to be around her where she wore the other ones. She doesn't like when I say this story, but they all smelled terrible. So I'd have to just like, it would just be brutal. She'd wear them in the bed. It would just be awful.
Oh, man.
And they would all smell terrible and they would be streaky colors. They wouldn't go. They were just way inferior products and the ingredient lists were terrible. It was just lots of chemicals compared to what ours looks like today. But I always thought, okay, look, if you could just make something this great, why didn't a billion-dollar business already do it? And we just got to the point where it was just no one did. And I guess when you talk about these other businesses, the jaded part of me, maybe the poker player part, said, well, obviously the people that have millions of dollars that are in these spaces already would have realized this, so clearly it exists. But sometimes it just doesn't exist, and there is actually an opportunity for you to step in. I mean, you see these on Shark Tank all the time. Someone has some idea and you're thinking, why is that already a thing? But the reality is that there actually can be great spots to have good business ideas and make money. And people like me shouldn't be so jaded.
Yeah, for sure. And I think like the biggest thing about like a physical products e-commerce business is if you're actually using the product, like Caitlin designed this product with this specific pain point in mind, there's likely other people in her shoes that are going to have that same pain point and want the solution that she created. So I think like, if you're just buying stuff off of Alibaba and slapping a logo on it and trying to sell it on Amazon, you probably could have crushed doing that in like 2015. E-commerce streets are much more competitive like on that front right now. But if you have a legit like brand and product you're building that you have a personal connection to, I think it's a great space to be in.
I really don't understand these business models where they just white label someone else's product and slap their own logo on it and try and sell it. I don't really get how people think that's going to work today. Maybe if you're Kim Kardashian and you're doing it, it'll be fine. But if you're just a normal person, or maybe even a small to medium-sized influencer, I don't understand how people think that that model is going to work. You're going to be competing against your own product that are just marketed differently under different labels. You really need to have some sort of unique value proposition that gives your customers value that the other products in the market just don't.
Yeah. And I think, as I'm sure you've learned, like selling things is just harder than people think. They think, oh, I've got, 50,000 followers on Instagram. I want to launch this athleisure brand and immediately sell out of my first run or something. There's a big difference between, fans or people saying they like something or they would buy something and someone actually putting down their credit card and buying something. So I do think that like that initial hurdle is tough to get over. But once you kind of get it, if people like the product, it can be a win-win-win. It's like they're getting a product they like, your business is doing well, we treat our suppliers really well, we want them to succeed. And I like that there's that positive sum force involved as opposed to, something like the gambling world where a lot of it at least feels more negative sum.
Well, it is. I win, you lose. That's like what you're striving for when you play poker, when you're trying to win and you're trying to make your opponents lose. So that is, whereas this is, I'm selling you something that makes you happy and being paid for it. Yeah. That is positive on both sides.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, in like a business like Self Tanner or Baby Shoes, like a lot of your business is going to be repeat purchases. So you want them to have like an amazing experience the first time they use a bottle of Nero Organics because it's, a replenishable product that like maybe you're even losing money acquiring a customer on the first sale. So you need to like put out a product that you're feeling proud of that you're not trying to scam someone to get this product. They're going to need to come back because they actually enjoyed it and spend more money on future purchases.
Yeah. And I've said this to Caitlin, I'm fine if we're losing money on initial customers that we get, because I'm so confident that our product is really good that I'm okay if we're losing some money here out of the gate. I think that people that once they see the quality of ours, they'll realize what this is about. It's funny because I sent one. So I don't have a lot of friends that are women. Shocking in poker and crypto. But anyway, so I reached out to people that I thought might have either their wife might like it or some women that I know. I just reached out to everyone to see if I get some feedback. And I sent one to Negreanu, which, man, what world, what sim are we living in where I'm sending Negreanu self-tanner units? And he said, I'll let you know what Amanda, his wife, thinks. And she loved it. She absolutely loved it. She was saying, like, can we get some more? He sent me a great DM. It was like, hey, can we actually get a few more units? Like, I'll pay for it, or we can just call it a rebate on the challenge. And I was like, you got it, man. They're in the mail.
That's great.
But it was great there because she's someone that actually uses products like this. Whereas a lot of the women that we have sampled these, they're not self tanning a bunch, right? So you really need that honest feedback from people. Where I know that the Negreanus aren't just trying to say this is a great product. Like clearly Amanda likes it, right? And that's good because I need that feedback to see that our product is good. Obviously, Caitlin loves it, but she made it, so it's going to be kind of hard for her to be truly unbiased. When you see that people do enjoy it, it's great to see, and you're onto something. So here's my question: at what point do you start to look at in-house versus outsourcing the product? Because right now we have a supply chain that goes through for different parts of the product, and we eventually ended up with our product. It took way more months than we wanted to. We were hoping to start selling probably November, December, ended up selling in mid-late January. I'm sure all supply side stuff is just brick city right now trying to get anything through. At what point did you start to look at maybe creating it in-house versus just ordering from these companies that you're outsourcing to?
Man, I'd be really hesitant to try to bring any of your manufacturing in-house, especially for something like that that's going on somebody's skin. I would really want an established skincare firm making it. We really try to work with our manufacturers to get everything nailed in at the manufacturer, and anything that shows up at our warehouse is ready to go. I think in your spot, you don't want to be, for a variety of reasons, learning how to mix the right chemicals and dealing with that.
You're saying you don't want me in the lab? Is that what you're saying? stay on the YouTube streets.
Yeah,
that seems fine. I mean, I guess my problem right now isn't our cost per unit, because everything's reasonable. The problem is just the amount of time. Everything just gets delayed. And I don't know, what's your take on if this will get better anytime soon? It seems like it hasn't for some time now. Do you think this is just the world we live in? There's going to be huge supply chain issues all the time, or will this eventually start to clear up with COVID stuff? Basically, am I going to have to wait 5 to 6 months to get more product or what do you think?
Yeah, it's tough because like there's a ripple effect in all this stuff. Like your stuff is made domestically, but you know the components are sourced everywhere, and all it takes is one little thing. Like if they're out of seals, you know they can have everything else for your product, but if they can't seal the cap, like you're stuck waiting until you get more seals. For our business, we import a lot of stuff from overseas, particularly from China and Pakistan. And when we started this business, importing a container from China to Port of Long Beach was $2,500 maybe. Quotes we've gotten on recent containers have been 30, 35K. It's like literally up 10X plus.
Oh my God. More importantly,
previously, you know, we'd book the shipment to be picked up in China and it would show up at our warehouse door in maybe 25 days. And now it's more like 90 days. So there's such a backlog to get through that I don't see this clearing up anytime super soon. That's for sure.
Well, it's not too bad right now because I bought enough units where if we started to ramp up big, we would have a lot of a runway because I knew that basically if this happened, it might take a while. And we're currently at, let's just say, if we doubled our sales, I would need to put another order in. If we doubled our current, we're selling every day. We're running ad sets and we're talking to influencers now and I'm shilling it on all of my channels, which somehow sells. By the way, I want to say thank you to all the poker bros buying self-tanner units. A lot of you guys. It doesn't go unnoticed. I definitely appreciate the support from the community. I didn't even know if we would sell almost any, but there's been a lot of love in the streets for the self-tanner. Definitely appreciate that from everybody. But if we doubled our sales right now, which is reasonable, we ramp up ads or if we get influencers, then I'm going to need to put the same order in immediately for thousands of units because it could take 6 months and then you don't want to end up in this. It's a good problem to have when you run out of product, I guess. It means that you're actually selling units, but it's tricky because you don't know what sales are going to be like down the road. So you're constantly playing this game where I have to think of this out months in advance. And if I'm wrong, then I end up with a bunch of units I can't sell or end up just having months where I can't sell any units. I know there's no magic trick to get around this. It's just something you have to deal with. But what has your experience been like dealing with those kinds of problems?
Yeah, inventory planning, I would say, is the toughest part of our business because it's this really tricky problem where you have both the supply side, where you can have delays and stuff there, and you have the demand side. Particularly for us, for like Amazon's a big sales channel of ours. If you know we're competing against people ranking for the keyword jujitsu gi for our jujitsu gi, and the number 2 and 3 sellers surprisingly go out of stock because maybe they had supply issues, well, now our demand side's out of whack.
Oh,
and like we start selling like crazy, but like, can you really base that into your inventory projections? Because those two guys are probably going to restock at some point, but we don't know if that's going to be in 2 days or 2 weeks. It's a really tricky problem. For a product like yours that's new, I mean, I would err towards like, if you guys are taking this seriously and want to do it, which like clearly you are, I would get a reorder going sooner rather than later. Just as you've already seen, things take way longer than you expect. And there's nothing more tilting than like having the demand side, but no supply.
All right. Well, I'm going to have to stop playing poker at the lodge so I can save up some money because all my spare cash is being funneled into paying everyone out what I lose at the lodge every month. I lost like 300 grand at the lodge last month.
That's impressive. What stakes is this?
Well, I lost 200. We were playing 100, 200, 400 basically one day. Okay. So that's, you know, there were some flips in there too. But then I also managed to lose, I don't know, 100-ish playing lower. I think I lost 50 playing nothing above about 510. But the thing is, it's Texas. So everything gets straddled and restraddled. So like the 510 definitely had some 510, 20, 40, 80. It's not that impossible to see happening.
Overall, how are we feeling about the experience of the poker room?
It's been good. It's been really good. It's been interesting being the house, you know, and thinking about things on both sides. There are a lot of things that you don't realize as a player, like trying to figure out structures. And we had 2 days we ran out of tables. I mean, obviously a good problem to have, mm-hmm. but we ran out of tables, you know. I mean, we're looking at other ways we can solve this, but that's not a problem you're thinking about as a player. When your player shut up, like, oh, this is great, lots of people playing. You're not thinking, oh God, people can't play. We have a wait list. Like that's something to think about. Just all the small little things. I think actually the big thing so far is just trying to listen to what the staff and players have to say and just try to really make changes that make people happy. Obviously people will have terrible ideas. Sometimes they'll say, you know what you need? And then they'll just say something. You're like, you think that's what we need? But then sometimes players have really good ideas or the staff, obviously, they work there. So they're there every day. They know the kinds of things that we need to change. And hopefully we can make some of those changes. We had to make a pretty tough decision recently where we had some really bad tech issues with our stream. And it was unfortunate because our stream started to do really well in the last week or two. We had a big week of events, and then we just had a bunch of disconnects on the stream. So people would be watching, and then it would just buffer, and we would just lose thousands of viewers sometimes. And we thought maybe that it was the people that were using the Wi-Fi at the location. The next day, we didn't have Wi-Fi. We cut Wi-Fi before the stream. Still happened. And then it happened again. So we kind of reached this point where it was probably easier to just say, we're going to put the stream on hold and solve our problems. And then when we come back, everything will be correct. But it just sucks having to do that when you're ramping up. You know, like the stream, we had a bunch of videos that did really well, got a couple hundred K views. I got set over setted, which everyone seems to love. So we had some stuff that was kind of going right. It was a great month for revenue, although obviously if we include factor my personal results in there, I'm down big at the lodge in January. But it's been a great first month. It's been
good. You got to bring the stream back with the greatest marketing stunt of all time, the return of Mike Possel.
Oh yes, that would be great. Live stream. That would be great that'd be good for branding. I want Mike Possel's face and the lodge. Just people think of them as the same thing. That'd be perfect. Yeah. All right. Well, anyway, Cole, that's all the stuff that I had. Oh, actually, you know what? It's not all the stuff. I had a couple questions I didn't get to earlier. Whatever happened to Townsend? Do you ever talk to him? Brian Townsend? You talked to him?
Yeah, I was on a ski trip with him last week, actually. He's very good friend of mine. Yeah.
That's awesome.
He's doing really well. He's a super private person, so don't want to blow up his spot too much, but he's doing great. He's in a great spot.
Cool. Glad to hear that. I don't think I ever met him, but obviously one of the OG online poker bosses. So I always wanted to know what ABBA can do in a week.
Yeah.
Remember that post?
He had all sorts of good ones. It's like $1 million dog, which I don't know if you came up with that rumor. Definitely wasn't true. But
what was that?
There was some like MVG thread that was rumored he spent $1 million on his dog. Like it was $1 million puppy or something like that like just caught fire. And then everybody kind of referred to his dog as $1 million dog.
Wow. I didn't know that, but apparently I missed out some lore. And then do you talk to Zygmunt still? What's he up to these days?
No clue. Yeah.
All right. Well, there you have it. All right. Before we go, Cole, anything you want to promote where people can either find you or stuff that you're up to?
No, I mean, you can find me on Twitter at Cole South, but yeah, just here for the conversation. Thanks, Doug.
If people want to get a high quality gi, do you know somewhere that they could stop by and, you know, something a little higher quality?
Absolutely. Jiu-jitsu is super popular with poker players too. I think it's a great outlet that kind of combines mental game and physical game. So goldbjj.com for all your jiu-jitsu gear needs.
Perfect. Thank you, Cole, for coming on today. And thank you guys for tuning in, whether you're watching live or you're listening to this or you're watching recorded. Appreciate having you every single week here at the Doug Polk Podcast. And once again, I've forgotten to see who my guest is for next week. I swear eventually I'll do a good job hosting. I just don't know how many months it will take. Either way, thank you for tuning in today, and I'll see you guys again next Tuesday.